Today is Sunday, December 6th, 2020. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart, H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm doing just great, Tom. How are you?
Good. Good to hear it. And Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you very much. Last time we wrapped up part one, your dad had been working for IBM, moving here and moving there, and they asked him to go, I guess, to Flint, Michigan, and he said, no, I'm going to Phoenix instead, to Scottsdale, and so moved you there in 1970, and can you pick that story up from there?
Yeah, sure, and it was quite a... quite an important time, I guess, for me, because I was getting into the high school years. I mean, in Texas, we had they had junior high there, and I went to the sophomore year, so that would be the ninth grade, I think, tenth grade, was trying to adapt to high school life there, and then in the summer of 70, we did make the move. I actually went, we moved out in early part of the summer in May, and then in August or July, late July, August, I went to a Knowles course,
oh, wow.
National Outdoor Leadership School in Lander, Wyoming, which was really exciting for me because it was just eye-opening to see the mountains, right, the real mountains. That was up in the Wind River Range.
Wow.
And we had great opportunity to go wilderness hiking there and rock climbing and my first introduction, more or less, to rock climbing. I'd done a couple of pitches at Philmont in New Mexico, Boy Scout camp, on a trip I took there with the scouts from Texas. But in the Wind Rivers, really got to, practice alpine mountaineering and climbing, rock climbing skills. So that was really a lot of fun.
How long was that course?
That was 5 weeks.
Wow.
You would go for 5 weeks. And they had a couple of... my recollection is that there was like 30 of us in the group, and we had a tent partner, and our tent was, it wasn't actually a tent, it was just a tarp that you would string up, and so I had a partner, Paul, who was from Boston, and then there were like five or six other people that we were close to, so it must have been kind of structured like the scouts, where you had a patrol or something like that. I don't remember exactly, but... in any event, you know, you kind of hung around with these five or six people, and then everybody would walk, you know, on a route through the wilderness there. There's a lot of wilderness areas in the Wind River Mountains, and most of it was off trail, which was really exciting. And and then if you'd make camp for a few days in a place, and then do some rock climbing or whatever, you know, to fill the time. It was a lot of fun, and very professionally done, too. I mean, there were some, as I found out later, there were a couple of hardcore climbers that were actually our leaders on these trips.
Oh,
and,
cool.
Because I heard about them doing climbs in Yosemite subsequently. So, I did that, and then as soon as I came back from that, basically I came out of that and went to, came back to Phoenix, back to my new house there, like I say, it was remember the first time I moved to Phoenix in 1960, we got off the train in the summer, and it was blazing hot at midnight. And, of course, coming to Phoenix or Scottsdale in July in 1970, it was very much the same story all over again, right? That really debilitating heat that it takes a while to get used to, for sure.
And you came right into the worst of it. I mean, the hottest
of
the
summer.
Yeah,
that's right. Wow. Yeah, yeah. So, and then I started, in the fall, I started at a place called Saguaro High School in Scottsdale, the north end of Scottsdale, and, it was just the typical thing. So this would have been the beginning of my junior high year, 11th grade, and, I was a new guy in town, I didn't know too many people, and I remember one day I was at a lunch table outdoors in the sun, at lunch hour, and I was reading Steve Roper's Yosemite Rock Climbing Guide, little green, rock climbing guidebook, And this kid walks up and he says, "So you're a rock climber, huh?" And, you know, I really wasn't a rock climber at that point. I'd done a few climbs with this Knowles trip in Wyoming, but I wasn't really knowledgeable. I was getting the bug though. So this guy sidles up and sits down. He says, "So you're a rock climber." And that was my friend, Chris Beal. And so we started a relationship there, and we've been friends ever since. We keep in touch, you know, to this day, not so much anymore, but we still do keep, we do keep in touch. And that's so we were chatting about climbing, and he was in the Scouts.
Okay.
So that worked out well, because, you know, I'd been in the Scouts in Alabama and Dallas before that. So I basically, you know, just went with him to a Scout meeting. I forget where it was held at this point, but the Scouts in Arizona were a little less structured than I'd been used to in Texas. And it basically just came down to guys, the Scouts, just going out on their own and doing things, which was great, you know. And I remember doing, overnight backpacks into the Superstitions with these guys. And so we're 16, I guess, or 15 maybe. Not quite sure how old you are when you're at that age, but I don't remember fathers being along or anything like that. And in any event, I didn't have an extended career in the Scouts in Scottsdale because, quite honestly, Tom, I just got into doing so much outdoor stuff that was like we didn't need the Scouts anymore. You know, we were just doing it on our own, and so. It was just, and Phoenix, of course, gives you that opportunity. It's just so much recreation, particularly from October, you know, to May. So many recreational opportunities just at your beck and call there, you know. And it was really, I think we talked about this last week. When I lived in Texas, you know, we found some great places to go in the Scouts, and my family would take trips to Big Bend and places like that. But there's really not a lot of open land, publicly accessible land in Texas. And so when I came to Arizona, it was just like, oh, my God, you can go anywhere, you know. And quite literally, because it's not heavily forested or thickly forested, you can go anywhere. You know, you can just start walking across the landscape. And most places you don't even need a compass, you know, if you have a good map or a sense of where you are. So it was great. It was a great experience for a youngster like me. You know, we touched on the fact in our previous discussion about how my parents were very supportive,
right,
letting me go on these trips. You know, it soon became that we were doing, you know, if not every weekend, but every other weekend, overnight trips somewhere.
Where did you go? What did you do?
Well, you know the Superstition Mountains?
Sort of.
The Phoenix? Yeah. And then there's another range to the northwest called the Matazals. And these are all in the Tonto National Forest.
Okay.
And there's just incredible hiking opportunities, desert hiking opportunities in those ranges. And as I came to appreciate quite quickly, you know, fantastic rock climbing opportunities too. And so we would just take off and head out to the soup. We call them the soups, right? Superstitions, but the soups. And it was just phenomenal because you park your car and you walk for a half an hour and you're into some pretty amazing wilderness. And even today, you know, the western edge of the Superstition Mountains, you have the Superstition Wilderness area there that abuts the city of Apache Junction boundary, right? So you have a wilderness area right adjacent to a city boundary. I assume that's the way it is. It used to be that way. I'm assuming it hasn't been changed. But the point is that in very short order, you can get into extremely wild country. And at that time, you know, that time hiking was kind of a fringe sport. I mean, it was only just kind of really weird nerd people that did it. So, you know, I quickly found the five or six hikers in my high school and started hanging around with them, and we just kind of fed on each other. So It was great, and like I say, you can go all winter long. You can go into these areas outside of Phoenix and explore. And
did you guys do that winter of 70-71?
Let's see. I think the first trip we did was Chris and I did a trip in the Grand Canyon. This is one of our early. We've done a couple of short backpacks in the Superstition Wilderness. But in the spring of 70, pardon me, Tom, here. You know, I should have my notes here. I should have my notes pulled up, and then I'd have all these dates and times perfectly. But I'm going to say it was Thanksgiving of 70. We decided to do our first Grand Canyon hike, and we drove up. We had I think my parents' Impala station wagon that we'd already had for like 8 years, and we drove up to the South Rim.
Did you have your driver's license by then?
Oh yeah. Okay. I got that in Texas.
All right, so you would have been 16. You would have been able to drive. You had a vehicle, and off you went.
Yeah, and so we drove up to the canyon, and I don't remember the details of where we parked or anything like that. But we made our way to Hermit's Rest. I don't even think there was a shuttle then. So, you know, we would have had to thumb out there or something because we parked our car, I believe, at the Bright Angel. Anyways, we went down the Hermit Trail, and we got there late. I remember the first night we camped was at the Hermit, the spring there in Hermit Basin.
The Santa Maria?
A little bit off the trail.
The Santa Maria Spring? Or
No, it's higher up.
Higher up, the Waldron.
It's up in the Coconino there.
Waldron Basin there. Okay.
Yeah, well, no, it's not Waldron Basin, but it was maybe it's not even a formal spring, but we camped right off the trail because it was late.
Yep.
And then the next day, we went down and went down to Monument Creek, and I remember being really struck by this monument, the spire that's there, right?
Yeah.
And the namesake for the creek. And we were looking at that thinking, wow, that'd be a neat thing to climb, you know. And so we did the obligatory walk down to the river there. And so that would have been my first view up close of the Colorado River, you know, seeing it directly one-on-one.
Hey, Jim, I wanted to ask you, so this is just you and Chris, and Chris's last name is spelled B-E-A-L, is that right?
It's two L's.
B-E-A-L-L, thank you.
Yeah.
And it's just the two of you?
Yeah, just the two of us.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you didn't even have to have permits then, I don't think. I'm not quite sure. The permit system was a little bit looser then, I do know that. But we didn't have a permit. And so we got down there, we spent, the afternoon going down to the river and back up. And then, for some reason, the next day, I don't know why, I guess it's just because I wanted to go as far as I could, you know, or as we could in the canyon, get as much hiking done as we could. I said, let's go to Clear Creek. I know there's this trail out east of Phantom Ranch, you know, that we could hike out. And so we had to hike the Tonto from Monument Creek, around past Salt and Horn and then down to Phantom Ranch and then up the North Kaibab there to the trail that the Clear Creek trail. And then we went all the way over to Clear Creek. It was a long day, I have to say.
That was a long day.
It was a long day, and we were pretty beat by the time we got there, and there were some scouts there that were camped there. I do remember that, and we wound up talking to them, and we mentioned to the scoutmaster. He said, "Well, where'd you come from?" Because we came in late, right? By the time we got there, it was after dark.
Okay.
And we said, "Well, we came from Monument Creek," and he just kind of couldn't believe us, right? Wouldn't believe us.
Mm.
And he did believe us, but I remember him saying, "Well, you boys must have just not seen anything, keeping your heads down on your looking at your feet." And I said, "No, I think we saw quite a bit, you know, because we don't really have to watch our feet when we're hiking."
Right.
And it may have been a little bit of presumptuousness on the part of these youngsters, right? These little punks on the hiking in the canyon. But there was a certain element of that. You know, you get into the zone and your feet just, they proceed automatically. You don't have to concentrate on them,
yeah.
At least with every step.
Yeah.
And So, you know, it was an interesting experience. And that would have been, yeah, that was our first hike together in the canyon.
Okay.
And
that
we
was
had,
your first, that was your first hike in the canyon.
Mine and Chris.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think he'd been there, before. So, you know, on his own, but, so it, my first hike in the canyon and his as well.
And then how did you exit?
Yeah, we just came up the Bright Angel Trail.
Okay, so yeah. In theory, your car was there. You had taken a shuttle out to Hermit's Rest to go down the Hermit Trail, and then they would put you back up near your car coming up to Bright Angel.
Right, right. And I do, I you know, quite honestly, Tom, we'd have to look into this, but I don't even think there was a shuttle then. So, you know, we would have thumbed out,
okay.
Right, hitchhiked.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, we could
that would make sense.
We could check with the Park Service and see when they implemented that shuttle. But I did a lot of that hitchhiking, you know,
okay.
over the years to get positioned for a start or
so,
an end.
So that was, you know, for your first hike, it's like day one basically gets you from the rim to the river. Day two gets you way up canyon. And day three gets you out.
That's right.
That's an aggressive hiking schedule right from the start.
Yeah, it sure was, and that, you know, because we always had to be back, you know, at the end of the weekend or something, back to Phoenix, you know, and I do remember now. I apologize for the loss of chronology here, but this was in the spring of 71. So, you know, I'd actually known Chris by this time about 6 months.
Okay.
And that had given us the time to do a number of hikes together in the Superstitions and whatnot. And we'd actually started our climbing career then, too, with a course that we took with the Arizona Mountaineering Club in Phoenix. And that was really good, you know, a first introduction to lots of rock climbing. Now, I'd had a lot of that already in Wyoming, right? And so I knew the basic knots and how to tie in and things like that. But, you know, the class at the AMC, Arizona Mountaineering Club, was more technical, for sure. And, you know, they took us up more pitches and with protection being placed, and we learned how to do that. And so it was a lot of fun, and it rapidly gave us experience rock climbing. And another thing about the AMC then is they had leaders who, you know, people, climbers who were sufficiently skilled and had demonstrated their skills and maturity to the leaders of the club, and so they could lead these climbs. And you probably know Bruce Grubbs.
I knew of Bruce. Yep.
Yeah. Well, Bruce was one of those climbers. He had lived in Phoenix for most of his youth and was active in
the club. Grubbs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. He lives in Flagstaff.
Okay.
And so he was a leader, and there was another climber named Suzanne Stites, S-T-I-T-E-S, and she led climbs.
Okay.
And another fellow named Mark Brown, with a K, and Brown, and he was one of these climbers. There were several of them, and let's see, I think Doug Rickard may have been a leader then, a climbing leader. I'm not quite sure, but.
R-I-C-K-A-R-D.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyways, we would go out on these climbs, right, and with these leaders. And we, you know, it was a great experience. We learned so much, and it was a great camaraderie with all the people. You know, there'd be like 10 people climbing something like, you know, the Hand, which is a big pinnacle that's on the northwest end of the Superstition Mountains. It's like a two-pitch climb, and so there'd be a bunch of people, and then we'd all get to the top, and then we'd rappel off, and it was a lot of fun, and you'd learn a lot of skills, you know. But the beauty of Phoenix is that you could go to Camelback Mountain on your own, you know, and just go climbing all day long, right?
Hmm.
You could go to Carefree, and there was well, there is still the rock pile there, the Carefree rock pile, but it's private property now, so you can't climb there anymore. But there were dozens of routes there that we just did over and over and over again, you know, honing our skills.
Okay.
And Pinnacle Peak, another great climbing spot up north of Phoenix. that we could go to, and you know, it got to the point where we would skip class in the afternoon and go to Camelback Mountain and climb, you know, 5 or 6 pitches.
Wow.
And then on the weekends, of course, we would do a day trip or an overnight trip into the Superstitions and you know, do some climbing there in the Pinnacles or at the Bart Canyon Wall or wherever, you know. And it just was a tremendous opportunity that we just dove into and just, you know, swallowed up and embraced it 100%. So,
and I'm assuming you ended up getting your own rope and your own harness and maybe some shoes and slowly, you know, pitons and hammers and jocks and blah, blah, blah.
Oh yeah, for sure. And you know, I worked in some restaurants. One of them was called The Other Place, which was on Lincoln Drive in Scottsdale. And I had a pretty lucrative job there that, like, a couple of times I would bring home $100 on a Friday night.
Wow.
So this is 1971, right? Really good money. And so I had money to buy this stuff. And I remember my first rope was a gold line rope,
yep,
right? From, was it New England Mills, I think? I'm not sure who made the gold line, but what a, you know, we just loved those ropes. And they're very, very coarse and thick and tough to handle, nothing like a purlon rope, right?
Right.
And but you know, you still was your, it was your lifeline, and so you know, we really loved these ropes. And at that time, you know, you didn't have harnesses. What you would get is like 30 feet of 2-inch webbing.
Yep.
And you'd wrap that around your waist, right? And it's called a Swami belt.
Yep.
And then you'd tie it off, and then you'd have another 1-inch webbing runner that you would kind of loop around your legs, and then you would attach that to the Swami belt with a carabiner, and that was your harness, right? So you had support around your legs,
right?
And you had support around your abdomen, but it wasn't very sophisticated.
No, it,
yeah,
it wasn't. And some people would take a piece of you know, 1-inch even webbing long and put 2 loops in it, tie those with knots. So they would step into those 2 loops, and then they would take this incredibly long tail and wrap it around their waist and then tie it to the free end where the 2 loops were, and then hook all that together with a carabiner, and that was the harness.
Huh.
So,
well, I never heard of that kind of a contraption before, but it makes sense.
Yeah,
I can see,
so just a couple different ways of,
yeah,
of doing the same thing, but that was the harness, in quotes, of the day.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say that was such a wonderful piece of instrumentation, but, you know, you realized that you didn't need a whole lot,
right,
to get by,
right,
in the wilderness. And I think, you know, when we started doing more serious mountaineering climbs in Wyoming and Montana and then in the canyon as well, you know, there are times that came up when you had to improvise.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing, you know, that you could use this basic equipment in ways that'll get you through jams safely, you know, maybe not as comfortably, but certainly safely, and that's what was count, you know, that's what you're counting on. That really benefited us in giving us the, you know, in contributing to our confidence level and going into these, you know, really sophisticated hiking expeditions and climbing expeditions that we went on. So, yeah, it was kind of a neat time, but of course your rack is growing very slowly because, you know, I did have some money coming in, but pitons were not cheap, you know.
Right.
And you had to buy pitons, you had to buy a hammer, and this is before the nuts. I mean, nuts were just starting to be talked about in the climbing literature, which was, you know, very minimal at that time. Summit magazine was there, and then I think Mountain magazine. They've both been long discontinued, and
right.
So Mountain was published in England, and that kind of gave you an insight into what was happening in Europe, right? And they had an international flavor too. Thank you. My wife just brought me a glass of wine.
Oh, great. Good.
We would devour these magazines, you know, and Summit magazine had a North American focus, and it was like hiking and like the 14ers and stories of that, and then once in a while some technical climbing, you know, and then of course we learned about American Alpine Journal, and that gave you insights into the more technical climbs that were being done. So it was a great time, but it was, you know, evolving very slowly for us, because as individual climbers, because we're advancing our skills, but you know that with the equipment that was available was very limited,
right,
and you couldn't afford to get a bunch of it at once. And so, slowly our racks accumulated and et cetera. And I remember my first Perlon rope. I mean, it was just a wonderful experience to be able to. I'd climbed on Perlon, so I knew what I was getting into, you know, but to actually buy one and then retire my goal line.
Goal line, yeah.
Yeah, it was a big step, you know, a big step in maturation, I think, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't see it that way at the time, but I just remember just looking on this splendorous rope, you know. And it was a blue one with yellow trim, you know, going down the middle, and so anyways, and I think it was $60, right?
Right.
For that Perlon, we climbed on 150s, 150,
yep.
150 foot lengths, and sometimes it was 165, I guess. And so that was the typical length we climbed on then, which I think.
And that was a heavy chunk of rope to be coiling up at the end of the day.
For sure.
So
sure.
How did you get your climbing Camelback and the Carefree Rock Pile and Pinnacle Peak? That rock is pretty good. Compared to the Canyon, which is here, hold this handhold because I don't need it. I'll just pass it over to you. Different type of rock. So how did you get familiar with, I mean, the Wind Rivers is granite. It's like just class A primo stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So how did you get familiar with the different rock in Grand Canyon to climb?
Sure. Well, there's no substitute for experience, right? Number one. But the reality is Camelback is pretty bad rock.
Oh,
it's,
okay.
It's basically an old tertiary debris flow. The head. I'm talking about the head. The spine, the hump, is an ancient granite. I think it's like Matazal age, so like a billion years or something like that.
Okay.
But the head, where all the main climbing is kind of like a debris flow that has solidified, and so it's kind of like a mud sandstone rock, right?
Hmm.
And with big boulders that are kind of like wrapped up in the debris flow, the ancient debris flow, and so you know the climbing there was dubious. I mean, the protection was dubious, and we relied a lot on bolts. There's not a lot of cracks there. At least they're not nice clean cracks. They're very rounded, and they bottom out. So you know, once in a while you could get a bong into one of these cracks if it was the right configuration. You know what a bong is? It's an aluminum piton that's very large.
Okay.
And like 10 inches long and 5 inches high. You know, each of the angles would be 5 inches high, and it's made out of aluminum and it's drilled out to keep it light.
Right.
And you can pound these things into very wide cracks, and they go bong, bong, bong when you're hitting them in. So that's how they got the name.
And you've got a hammer, and so pretty soon I'm like, gosh, you've got enough aluminum hanging off your shoulders to build a small aircraft.
Oh, yeah. The racks were quite heavy, because you'd have all these pitons. And now, not for Camelback, because Camelback, you knew what you were getting into on those climbs, you know? And there wasn't a whole lot of protection. It was kind of running it out. And I'm not saying that these were 5'11s by any means, you know. They were 5'6", 5'7", 5'4", things like that.
Good skill-building stuff.
Definitely. But then, of course, Pinnacle Peak was granite, you know, and the Matazals were metamorphic rock, but very, very tough, right?
Yep.
The superstitions were are volcanic and better than Camel's Head, but still, you know, secondary in quality Pinnacle Peak. So the, my point is that we were exposed to a lot of different quality of rock.
Okay,
right?
Good. Yeah.
And, you know, before we started climbing in the canyon, I mentioned that, that monument spire, and that, that'll, you know, that comes up fairly early on. But the summer of 71, Chris and I decided we would go to the Wind Rivers and on a climbing trip. And because I had been there the year before, right, in 1970 with Knowles.
Right.
And then, so, you know, we hit it off as friends, and we said, we decided to plan a six-week trip to the Wind River Range to go climbing.
Wow.
And so we put this trip together, and I can't believe that, you know, our parents let us go, and they, but they did. And we were actually threatening to hitchhike up to Wyoming because, you know, the parents were a little bit resistant. And at that point, Chris's parents, who have both passed away now, they said, okay, we'll drive you up. They had a Volkswagen Bug, you know.
Okay.
So they said, we'll drive you up to Wyoming and drop you off and pick you up at the end of your 6 weeks. And so so we did, and we went up there in like mid-July or early, you know, first part of July.
Without wheels, where were you thinking to resupply?
Well, what we did was, you know, because I by this time I'd been in the Wind Rivers for 5 weeks, a trip myself.
Okay.
And that winter, I devoured everything I could find. There's the classic guidebook to hiking in the Wind River by a guy named Finus Mitchell, Hiking and Climbing. I had that book, and, you know, it's like when you're young and you're so inspired, you just devour every page, every word that's written about these places.
Right.
So, you know, I had that book to plan. And so what Chris and I decided to do was we put together our food in three batches for 2 weeks each,
okay.
Right? And so we identified two spots on the west side of the Wind River Range where we could drive in and leave our cache at a ranger station.
Great.
One was a ranger station and one was a ranch. And so we did that. And then, you know, that would allow us to go 2 weeks, and then we'd take a day to get out to the ranger station, grab our cache, and then another day to get back up into the mountains, right?
Great.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And, like, you know, the two of us are up there, and most of the time we would be, you know, up in the alpine above timberline and off trail because we were just kind of going, you know, walking the high valleys instead of the trails. I mean, the trails were the network that got you down low to your car, right?
Right.
Or your cache or whatever. But, you know, we wanted to spend time up in the high country, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where the climbing was too. So,
yeah.
So it would, we did this trip and it was 6 weeks long and, we saw, you know, I don't know, I can't say for sure, but probably 20 people the entire time, you know?
Wow.
And, it was just an amazing experience. And we did so much climbing, you know. We were up there, and a couple of times we were really pushing our limits. Nobody knew where we were, right? Nobody had the faintest idea where we were except
right.
in the Wind River Mountains. And we didn't leave a detailed map of where we were going to be because we didn't know where we were going to be. We just kind of walked where we wanted to, you know. No satellite phones. We didn't have any ELTs or anything like that. We were just totally dependent on our skills and each other.
Mm-hmm.
And
nice.
By that time, we knew we could count on the other guy, you know.
Okay.
When
yeah.
you spend that much time hiking and climbing with somebody, you know the bond you have, and you understand the strength of that bond,
mm-hmm.
right? And
mm-hmm.
so I knew that that Chris was the best person there to help me deal with a problem, you know.
Mm.
And quite honestly, you know, we were probably young, and when you're, you know, carefree like that, you don't really think about your mortality.
Right.
But we did, you know, a number of first ascents up in the Wind Rivers, and then we climbed Gannett Peak, the highest peak in Wyoming. That summer.
It takes a couple of days to get to get in there, doesn't it? A couple of days to get in, a couple of days to get out.
Oh yeah, and the last third of our trip, though, we you know, we did 3 2-week stints, right? So we had to get those food caches in the middle there.
Right.
And so the last third was all in the Titcom Valley area of an island lake.
Okay.
And Dinwiddie Glacier. So that's where we did our climbing of Gannett. It was up in that northern part of the range. The first part we spent in an area called the Mount Bonneville area, if you're familiar with that. And then, I'm sorry, that was the middle part. And then the first part we were down in a place called Cirque of the Towers.
Okay.
So those are the three main areas that we focused on.
Mm.
And so, yeah, we went down and picked up our food cache at a ranger station that was, you know, somewhere in the vicinity of the Island Lake Trailhead. I think that's what it was called. It's been so many years now. Mm. But there was a ranger there who was more than happy to let us store our food there for 4 weeks, and then we'd pick it up, you know, and then for the last 2 weeks. And then, you know, by that time we could hike from the parking lot at the Island Lake Trailhead up to Titcom Valley,
mm.
you know, even with 100 pounds of food on our backs,
right.
or whatever that was,
right.
you know, we could do that in an easy day, you know, because you're in such great shape.
Yeah,
And so that was just, these resupply days were just kind of like, you know, you'd put on an empty backpack and just kind of run down the trail for 20 miles to get to the I think it's only 16 miles, so I'm exaggerating a little bit, but to get to the ranger station and then load up and then, you know, carry everything back up. And it really was just like a fun day to.
Did you put out a little postcard to, you know, mom and dad, hey, you know, second 2 weeks is done and we're ready for the third? And...
Yes, we actually did that.
Okay.
We actually did that. I'm glad you reminded me of that because I'd forgotten that. We did do that. Chris sent some to his parents and then I sent some to my folks.
Cool.
And that did help my mother in particular deal with the stress, you know, because she...
Yeah.
Here's her 16-year-old kid, you know, he's up in Montana, he's up in Wyoming somewhere, you know, rock climbing, and nobody knows where the hell he is,
right,
and
right.
anything. So it was difficult for her, you know, mm. and much more than I appreciated at the time, you know, like I say, we felt very confident of our abilities, and we also backed off a lot of stuff, Tom. You know, that was another thing we learned is that you can't push it, right? If the weather's bad, you know, because we had lightning storms on a number of occasions, and we'd be up on a climb. There was one climb we did in Titcom Valley on a mountain, a peak called the Buttress, and it was the first ascent, but it started sleeting.
Mm.
You know, this was in the first part of August, and it started sleeting, so we had to back off it. You know, and you learn your limits, and.
Right.
And, you know, nothing is worth pushing, I think, to get, you know, to accomplish if it really seriously jeopardizes, you know, your safety and well-being or your partner's. And so that's always, you know, we learned that early on, and that was always a guiding principle. And I think that's, you know, served us well to the present day, for sure. So, yeah, it was a wonderful experience for
nice.
Sure. One of the highlights of my life. And every time I get together with Chris, we inevitably talk about, you know, our experiences, our shared experiences that summer.
Yeah.
You know.
And then his folks came back up and picked you up.
Yeah, they came back up. So, you know, that's pretty admirable to drive from Phoenix to Lander, Wyoming, and just to drop your kid off. Now they were hikers too and backpackers, so they had their own plans, and I think they did some hikes in Wyoming and Utah, you know, while we were
right.
gone away. And
oh, good
they,
for them.
Yeah, they did come back up at the end of the trip and brought us back to Phoenix. So, and we were all four of us. I remember particularly driving up there because we were all four of us crammed into this bug with four backpacks.
Right.
Plus all our food for 6 weeks.
Right.
And climbing gear. You know, it was just, we had a roof rack, which was just hugely, you know, packed. And then, you know, you could fit your rope in the trunk on the front of the Volkswagen, you know, on top of the spare tire.
Right.
You could cram all your iron, you know, into the little spaces around the spare tire, and iron being the pitons and stuff, right?
Right.
The rack.
Right.
And so, yeah, we had that car just everything, every square inch was packed, you know, under the
I
seats.
bet.
Yeah. But, you know, more power to Chris's parents for
Yeah.
taking us up there. You know, I think they knew that we were kind of, I don't think we were necessarily bluffing about hitchhiking, but we knew it would be a big order of business because we had all this gear, you know.
And it's funny because the most dangerous thing you could do would be to hitchhike up there, and the parents say, "Okay, we'll drive you.
Yeah,
you can
right.
climb. We don't care. 6 weeks, that's fine. But
yeah.
we're going to make sure you get where you're going and get home
yeah.
again." Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
That's right.
Huh.
So I'm sorry we're not talking about Grand Canyon too much, but
we'll get there.
Okay.
No rush here. It's all right.
Oh, it's great to be able to reflect on these experiences, you know. So.
Yeah, I mean So in the fall of 71, you're a senior in high school. Where did you go climbing then?
Well, same thing, right?
Okay.
I mean, we would go to the Superstitions, to the Matazal Mountains, to Pinnacle Peak, to the Carefree Rock Pile, Camelback Mountain. We would go down to Tucson, into the Santa Catalina.
I was going to say, did you get into Babakivari, points further south?
Eventually, yeah.
Okay.
Eventually, we didn't go down there too much because it was kind of unknown for us at that time.
Okay.
And I mean, of course, I knew about Babo and that it had been climbed and that there was a way up, and so but we didn't get there at that time. And like I say, there was plenty of stuff to keep us busy in the Valley of the Sun, right?
Okay.
And
all right.
That was our main focus. At one point we did take a trip to Talkeets in Southern California. Talkeets Rock, went over there to go climbing. So that's a big dome complex, granite dome complex east of Los Angeles area.
Oh, really? Okay.
Up above Palm Springs, really.
Hmm. So you know, Joshua Tree?
Yeah, we went to Joshua Tree, too.
Okay.
Yeah, Chris and I spent a winter there for about 6 weeks in, I think, 74. So this was after high school ended.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, okay.
So we were, you know, we kind of explored the climbing areas that were, you know, fairly adjacent to central Arizona, and then all of, you know, of course, thinking about things like the Wind Rivers, and which we went back to a subsequent year, 76, I think. There was plenty to do, Tom. So
okay.
We didn't have to go that far afield, and it was the same climbing areas, and you know, and we had no problem doing, you know, Deception at the Carefree Rock Pile 42 times, right? You know, it wasn't
okay.
that big a deal, and at the end of it, of course, we're free soloing all these things. We got so confident with the climbing that we didn't need the rope for a lot of these climbs, right?
Okay. All right. Yeah.
And so, you know, but it was always fun, and I have to say, you know, I talk about this with Chris a lot. It wasn't necessarily the actual climbing that was so much fun. It was just the camaraderie, you know, being out with your friends. And because we did a lot of laying around, too, you know, in the sun and shooting the bull, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just having a good time and looking at flowers. And, you know, the climbing was great, and it was kind of like the binding glue. But I think... Well, no, that was the shared experience, but the binding glue was the, you know, the emotional contact that we had with our friends when we're doing all this, you know. And the fact that you're just out there enjoying the natural world, you know, the brilliant sunshine of the Arizona sun, you know, in the winter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, and it's cool, but it's nice and toasty in the sun. And, you know, you're just sitting there relaxing and looking out at the world. And of course, great geology too. I didn't appreciate it at the time because I didn't know I was going to be a geologist, but I was very interested in the geology and the landscape and all that. And there was so much to think about there. So, yeah, it was a great place to grow up. And I think I mentioned that last week that you know, for me, moving to Arizona was kind of almost transformational because it just did allow me to bond so much, to see that the outdoor world was so much greater than anything I had considered before, you know. So
yeah. So were you thinking, well, okay, we should probably do some more hiking in Grand Canyon? Or was it just, wow, this, well, where do we want to go now? There's, I mean, if you think about it, there's north, south, east, west from Phoenix. Wherever you go, there's going to be good climbing in whatever direction you're going to go.
Yeah.
So I can appreciate that Grand Canyon might not have been like way up on the radar screen. Hey, let's go back there.
Yeah, it wasn't way up, and quite honestly, from the climbing perspective, it wasn't a high priority destination because at that point, you know, 71, 72, I knew about the Grand Canyon. As I mentioned to you last time we talked, I'd been there when I was a little kid and seen it and been really inspired by it, and I wanted to go back, and it was one of those places that it seemed so far away from Phoenix, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I think part of that was because we didn't quite understand the logistics that would be involved in hiking in the Grand Canyon. I didn't know the extent of the trail system, and at this point, I was just starting to get exposed to Harvey Butchert's notes, you know, in his Treks book.
Yep.
And so, you know, it wasn't obvious that there was a lot of. Like now, I look at my map of the Grand Canyon, and I realize that you can go anywhere, right? Almost
right.
anywhere,
right.
And I know all the access points, right? Or most of them, and I know how difficult they are. I know how long it takes to get there, and all that kind of stuff. But you know, quite honestly, when I was 17, and we're looking at a map of Grand Canyon, and you see Great Thumb Mesa, it's like, how the hell do you ever get out there? You know,
right.
And I didn't realize that the roads were okay, you know, for a reasonably, with a high clearance vehicle, you know, you could get most places. And so we didn't know that at the time. And so it was kind of like this terra incognita, and that partly was the reason that we didn't spend a lot of time there, you know. And again, we were so involved with the rocks and the hiking close at hand that we didn't have to think about that. But it was always in the back of our minds, you know. And in particular, after Chris and I had seen that spire, the monument
right,
spire
right.
in Monument Creek,
right.
you know, we knew we wanted to try that.
Yeah.
And so eventually in the fall this would have been the fall of 71 now, so after our summit in the Wind Rivers, we organized a trip down there to climb it.
Mm.
And I'm almost embarrassed to say we only got up like 25 feet.
It's a really hard climb.
Yeah. Well, we actually were trying to climb it on the south side, and I, you know, the route, I haven't actually, to this day, I haven't climbed it. So,
right.
Have you climbed it?
I have not climbed it, but I've watched
yeah.
some other people do it, and it's hard, and it's on the north side. You kind of go up, and you got to work around, and it's a very difficult climb.
Yeah, for sure, 5'10", I think, and so. But we, you know, went down there. We had all our equipment, and you know, we climbed. I'm just looking at one of these pictures from that climb is on my desktop, right? So
cool.
it cycles through every couple of days, and
yeah.
I see it. And we're sitting there, and we got wool knickers on.
Oh my
Can
gosh!
Can you believe this? Because this is what we climbed with in Wyoming, right? And you know, in that case, you know, wool knickers and wool socks, you know, and your Kronhofer clutter shoes or you know, your Alpspitz mountaineering boots, whatever you were climbing in at that time, you needed that because of the weather,
yeah,
problematic weather. And there weren't a lot of options. This is long before polypropylene or
That's
anything
right.
like that, you
That's
know.
Right.
So you basically lived and died in wool. And so, you know, that was our climbing gear in the canyon. The first couple of trips, we brought this gear down, and I see myself, you know, in this picture, and I've got
uh-huh.
this helmet on and a wool jacket, you know, and wool pants. I think it was cold, right?
Mm, yeah, yeah.
But nonetheless, it was totally crazy for Grand Canyon climbing. But yeah, we got up like 25 feet from on the south side trying to climb, and there's this, the pinnacle, of course, is all Tapete sandstone, but at the base of it, there's the Archean, the granite there,
yeah,
right?
It's schist.
That's right, and so on the south side, it's actually there's a big dike of Zoroaster granite.
Right.
It's all rotten, and that's what we started up because we were hoping to get to the you know, there's an overhang at the sandstone, and then you have all these horizontal cracks, and there is a crack system that's vertical there, and so we thought we could work our way up this, but you know, we got up like I don't know, 25 feet on this really poor granite, and it was just crumbling in our hands, you know. So we backed off, you know, and that was a sobering experience that this canyon climbing is it's a little bit more than you know, just a cursory drive up from Phoenix and then run down and climb up a spire, you know. It's a serious thing.
Did you have any information from anyone else about the route? I'm assuming you didn't.
Oh, no, I assumed it was unclimbed. I think it was unclimbed.
All right.
And so it wasn't until many, many years later, like 25 years later, that I found out that the route, you know, at that point, the route that had been climbed was on the north side. And as far as I know, that's the only route that has been climbed.
Yeah.
So,
okay. All right. You're finishing off your high school year. Were you thinking about college? Were your folks thinking, okay, Jim, we want you to go to college? And you were working at a restaurant. Did you keep working?
Yeah, I kept working there. I was making really good money there. And
were you waiting tables? What were you doing?
No, I was actually called the. It was called the. The head bus.
Okay.
So there was a team of bus boys.
Yep.
And they would wait on. They would clear the tables, right?
Yeah.
And help the waiters, right?
Yep.
And so and this was a pretty fancy steakhouse, you know. I don't know what it would compare to today, but it was called Dale Anderson's Other Place. And, you know, people would get dressed up on the weekends and, you know, they'd be dropping $200, right,
wow,
for a party of four or something like that. It was a big, big thing. And lots of alcohol and high-end wines and stuff like that, and steaks and seafood. Anyways.
So if you bust hard for the waiters, they would see their tip money go up, and they would share that.
Exactly. That's exactly the way it worked. And
okay,
I realized early on, you know, that if you want to make money, you got to befriend these people and work for them. And so I really worked hard there. And I also cooked. I did some of the cooking. I worked on the line part of the time.
Okay.
But I got to be the head bus boy, and the head bus boy would kind of, like, keep the other guys in line. And then I also had to prepare all the salad, keep the salad the area where the waiters put together the salad bowls and the bread and the soups and all that, they put those together but I had to make sure that all that material was available for them, right? And so they would give me an obligatory cut of their tips, which was for the busboys, right?
Okay.
As a group, and then they would give me extra, right?
Wow.
This is for you, Jim, right? For helping me out and doing all this stuff. And so, you know, then at the end of the night, after everything was done, we'd sit down, the busboys, and we'd divvy all this up, right? And like I say, I would come home like a couple of times, not all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the
mm-hmm.
time was like 40, 50, 60 bucks, but
right,
a couple of times $100, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I busted my butt on those nights. I can remember just being drenched in sweat. We had to wear white shirts and and black slacks, you know, and just being drenched because of the running around. And everybody was like that. You know, these were all college guys, the waiters, you know.
Okay.
All clean-cut guys. They were ASU students, you know.
Okay.
The bus boys, you could, because if you were working in the back, in the kitchen, something like that, you could have longer hair, you know, because you weren't directly interacting with the clients.
Right.
And so that's partly why I was back there, because my hair kind of started to get long then.
Uh-huh.
And it was a real good money making experience for me, and it taught me the value of hard work, you know.
Okay.
And how to get along with people, because not all those waiters were nice. You
right.
know, most of them were, but some of them were nasty, and you just got to figure out how to work with them, you know,
right,
so that everybody benefits.
Yeah,
that's what I learned. So.
And what were you thinking as you were kind of rounding out your high school? Were you looking to go to college?
Oh yeah, I was. The expectation was there. My parents. I mean, they from a very early age, they basically said, you know, presumably you're going to college, right,
mm-hmm.
kid, right?
Right.
And so we were thinking about it. I had some pressure from my aunt, who was a social worker that lived in Massachusetts, to go to Ivy League schools.
Huh.
And so I put in some applications to Dartmouth and Yale, and I wasn't accepted. And it was kind of like, oh, well, okay, you know.
Uh-huh.
But I kind of thought...
ASU calls, you know.
Yeah, I just wasn't strongly motivated to go to college at a university. Up here, they call it university. In the States, we go. You say you're going to go to college, right? Yeah. I just wasn't that motivated because I was thinking, you know, I'm happy just being a rock climber, right? And like, I love this lifestyle, that working in the restaurants and getting up money. And you know, the restaurant was nice because they would let me take off for 2 months, right?
Nice.
And then come back to work. And so I just wasn't really strongly motivated. And neither was Chris. Chris is probably the smartest person I have ever met. And I don't say that lightly. He is a genius. I know his IQ is way off the scale. And he was going to the university because he felt pressured by his family as well, you know. And anyway, it wasn't that I felt like I wanted, I felt like I needed to better myself eventually, but I felt like at this time of my life, why not just kind of run the rock climbing thing for another few years, you know? And so we kind of did that. Chris went to a place, a school named Colorado College, which is in Colorado Springs.
Okay.
It's a small liberal arts school. And he went 1 year, and then he quit. And then I went to Scottsdale Community College. I took 6 months off and then went to Scottsdale Community College and took things like typing, and which has served me very well ever since, and calculus. I took calculus because I knew if I was going to go to school, you know, go to university, I would need calculus for science programs. I took things like English and statistics, basic courses, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
In the community school. But without any real focus on how I was going to put it together, you know. And so when Chris was gone, I had to switch climbing partners, which was not that difficult. I mean, I found other partners, but it wasn't quite the same emotional connection that I had with Chris. And so, you know, I still kept climbing, though, and building my skills up. And So Chris finally came back from Colorado in the summer. This would have been the summer of 73, I think, now. We both graduated
in 73.
72.
Okay.
And he came back from in the spring, or, you know, late spring of 73. He says, I'm done. I'm not going to go there anymore. And so we started planning what we could do. And actually, what we decided was that we would go hang out in Colorado Springs in the fall of 73 and climb in central Colorado, right? And it turned out to be this great scam that we ran, that, you know, I'm kind of semi-embarrassed to talk about it now, but we basically, Chris had a lot of friends from his junior, his freshman year at Colorado College, and we wound up just building a loft in one of their, you know, dorm rooms. They had these huge ceilings, like 25-foot ceilings, and we built a loft up in one of these, and the four of us would sleep up there in our sleeping bags, you know, and Chris and I just hung out at Colorado College for like 6 months and rock climbed and skied, and we even, you know, we even got cards to use the cafeteria.
Oh, wow.
And so it was kind of like, you know, it was probably the sleaziest thing I've done in my life as far as ripping off the system goes, because we were definitely taking advantage.
Well, what did you do for money? I mean, you clearly needed money for fuel to, you know, get out to go climbing, and some money for food. And...
Yeah, and exactly. Well, you know, I had made a bunch of money, and, you know, a couple thousand dollars I had saved up from the restaurants.
All right.
But Chris and I mean, at the time there was this great option that you had, and we did this all the time. I don't know if this still exists, but there was a company called Manpower.
Yep.
And wherever you were in any sort of major or medium-sized city, you could just look up Manpower in the Yellow Pages, call them and say, I need a job. And, you know, the next day you'd be put to work, you know, loading trucks or, you know, doing anything for minimum wage. And you know, you'd work a day and you'd feel beat and you'd have like $40 in your pocket, and that was enough to keep the Volkswagen going for, you know, a week. And so you didn't need a whole lot, especially if you're scamming the university for your lodging and your food, right?
Yeah.
And so, we definitely kind of, you know, lived it up there. And
so did you get up to Boulder and climb the Flatirons? Mm-hmm. Did you get up to Long's Peak? Did you get up to the Diamond over there?
We did all that. We did not climb the Diamond per se, but we climbed Long's.
Okay.
And
did you go up the south side of Long's, or just the traditional route up through the Keyhole and that?
Yeah, the traditional route.
Okay.
I think they call it the Friday route at the time.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and so we were up there, and there was a storm that came in, and we had kind of an epic getting down. Mm. You know, it was no problem. We just kept our wits about us and managed to get down the timberline. Everything was okay, but it just. You know, it's one of those situations where the Rocky Mountain weather at the Alpine just can change on a dime, you know, and all of a sudden you're kind of in trouble.
And Gore Canyon, I mean, there's just a ton of canyons out there to go climbing in, some pretty good rock.
Yeah, we kind of stayed in the front ranges there.
Okay.
Garden of the Gods,
yep,
which is in Colorado Springs.
That's right.
And it's the same, more or less the same rocks as the Flatirons.
Yep.
And then of course, yeah, the front ranges up in Rocky Mountain National Park there, we climbed up in there. And then we did a trip. I remember one time we went up to Wyoming. We spent a week there. We climbed Gannett Peak in, like, I'm going to say 20th of October, something like that, really late.
Okay.
In the season, and I remember there were three of us, Chris and our friend Tom Baxter and myself, and we got to the summit of Gannett. This was like a weekend trip out of Colorado Springs.
Wow.
And I think a 4-day weekend, like a holiday or something. And we got to the summit of Gannett in late in the afternoon, and we're coming down, and we had to bivouac.
Right.
And there was a so we found this rock wall with a little tiny space at the bottom of it. We could excavate some of the snow around it, and one person could get down flat, and two people had to stand. So Chris and I stood the whole night while Tom just snored down at our feet, you know. It was so funny. But that's how we got through that night, and it was just snowing, you know, just snowing all night long, and we're just knocking it off our parkas and chatting and keeping each other from, you know, falling down or anything like that. So anyways, we did Gannett Peak, and not quite a winter ascent, but it was a very late season ascent. And that's, you know, we just kind of kept busy in the Colorado area. We were up in, we went up to Glacier Park at one point, and didn't really do any climbing there, but wound up getting stuck in a shelter cabin at a place called, I think it's called Gunsight Pass.
Okay.
And we were stuck there for like 5 days during a blizzard.
Wow.
and just barely could find our way back to the car because our tracks had been obliterated. And it all worked out, though. You know, it all worked out, and it was just another great few months that we had together. You know, enjoying the wilderness and the country and climbing and our bond with each other, you know, and all the other people we met too climbing in that area.
I'm trying to place a climber in this time frame called Leighton Kaur.
Oh yes.
Did you ever meet him?
No, I never met him.
But you must have heard of him.
Oh yeah. I mean, there was, you know, I don't want you to think that I was not climbing at anything the level of a Leighton Kaur or a Tom Frost or a Royal Robbins or anything like that, you know. We were climbing 5'7", 5'8", 5'9", which, you know, on crappy desert rock, it's an accomplishment, right? Especially back then with you know, not the stickiest soles on your shoes and the fancy cams and all that kind of stuff. But it was not the highest standard of the day. And so people like Leighton Kaur, you know, we kind of thought of him as a god. And Fred Beckey, you know, I mean, kind of like the ultimate North American mountaineer, you know, unfortunately died what, 2 years ago, I think, something like that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, these guys were, you know, from our perspective, these guys were the immortals,
right?
You know, the
gods.
And
they've been climbing in the '60s, isn't it?
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they've been setting up some hairball routes and just doing some amazing climbing stuff.
Oh,
Yeah.
yeah. Fisher Towers, I remember
Right.
being mesmerized, seeing photos of that and Core and Hurley's ascent of the Fisher Tower there, and just tremendously rotten
Yeah.
mudstone pinnacles, in Canyonlands country.
Right.
And
Right.
but none of these guys ever got to the Grand Canyon.
Right.
It was just it was kind of an unknown from the climbing scene, except to people like Harvey Butcher
Who
and
wasn't much
Alan
of a
Doty
much of a climber? Yeah, Gansey. Those guys in the late 50s, Tidrick and some of those guys were out there certainly in the 50s and 60s. Merle Klub, of course,
Yeah.
CLUBB, was out there in the 40s, but few and far between. Alan McRae, so but they not a lot of people knew about them or what they were doing.
No, not at all. And I often wondered, I'd love to talk to Tidrick. Do you know if he's still alive?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because I should try and get a hold of him, because I often wonder what brought those guys from Southern California to the canyon, and where did they see, and they must have seen pictures of these summits and thought, let's go do it, right? Because otherwise, why would you, I suppose if you come here on a holiday and, just went to Point Imperial as a tourist, and you, if you're a rock climber, you're going to see that and you say, I got to go climb it, right? I mean, it could have been that too.
But there were climbing clubs in the 60s that were out there doing, Mount Sinala and just Vishnu Temple, some really difficult stuff in Grand Canyon. It was happening. They
Yeah.
just were few and far between and relatively scattered and unknown.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. It and I think partly that reflects the thinking that I was talking about earlier, where there was a it, you look at a map of Grand Canyon 1970, if you're like me, it's a vast region of complexity, and I didn't understand the axis,
Right,
And I
right.
didn't realize how one could get into these places relatively easily.
Right.
And also I didn't realize how relatively easy it is to get around there if you know what you're doing,
That's right.
and if you're in shape.
Yeah.
And so if without that kind of background knowledge, which I think most people didn't have, even in the climbing community, it was just this big chasm that was kind of like inhospitable and remote and too distant and crappy rock to start with, so why would you even want to go, right?
That's right.
So yeah, it was an interesting time. And slowly, though, of course, as more and more people started, climbing there and word started getting out, well then, people started to realize that it was more of a destination,
Right.
And I mean, in my own case, it was reading Butchert's notes, and
Okay.
so eventually, at some point here, we're going to move on to the next phase, I guess, which is when I go to school in Tucson at U of A. And there I found in the special collections, I found Harvey's actual notes, right? They were photocopies.
Okay.
But of all the notes that he had written at NAU and which are, now at the Klein
Right.
library.
When
And but
did you decide, all right, I'm going to go to college?
yeah, so we had this fall in '73, Chris and I.
Right.
And we're running around, the Rockies in Colorado, and just having a great time. And then in the spring or winter of '73, so just after Christmas, we went to Joshua Tree, and we spent about 2 weeks there. And I kind of started thinking, there's a little bit more to life than just doing this climbing thing, don't get me wrong, I mean, we're having so much fun, but I just felt like there's more, I've got more ambition to do something else. I didn't know
Okay.
what that was, right? But I figured it would be well served by going to the university.
Okay.
And so at some point that spring, I had to tell Chris that I was going to go back to the university. I was going to go to the university because all I'd done is gone to community college,
Right.
right? And I remember, because he had given up his career, his college career at Colorado College, which is a pretty prestigious school, by the way. At the time, it was pretty tough to get into. I'm sure it still is. And he had quit that partly so that we could do climbing together, okay. You know. And so here, 9, 10, 12 months later, I'm telling him, you know, we've had a great run, but and it doesn't have to end, right? But I'm gonna transition to another phase in my life, right, by going to the university. It was a little difficult to tell him that, right? But he was fine with it, you know, and partly because you know, he knew there was more to life than just climbing, right? And it was just a question of time when we would make this transition, and eventually, I mean, he followed me down to Tucson anyways, right?
Okay.
And so we both climbed down there, but while we were taking classes, and so, yeah, so
did
that
he
happened.
Did he go to U of A, University of Arizona, in Tucson as well?
Yeah, he did too. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So he studied physics, and I went through a number of different majors before I finally settled on geology.
You know what? We've been going about an hour and 10 minutes here. Maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this oral history, and we will pick this up in the fall of 1973 at the University of Arizona.
Okay. You know, this is so much fun, Tom. It's really great talking to you and sharing these stories, because a lot of this stuff, it's like I kind of had forgotten some of these things, right? And they, as we're talking here, they just come up,
and
it's a really neat opportunity to relive some of these experiences from my youth. So, yeah, it's great. I really appreciate you taking the time to hear me out.
Oh, thank you very much. There's much yet to come, so I'm looking forward to that. But it's always good to know how, you know, what builds people, what was happening, and I just look at this and go, oh my gosh! By 1973, you had a huge amount of orienteering and climbing skills, just huge. So you know, Grand Canyon was just awaiting you. So really interesting to put that together. So with that, then, this will conclude part two, oral history interview with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, December 6th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate talking to you.